second of 3 hours on a Bud Light Football Friday on the Fan. Sandy Clef with you. Bud Light, the official beer sponsor of the NFL. Here we go. Of course, this as always is your station and your home for the best live and local coverage. The Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3, The Fan. Dr. Rick Perea, in the middle of the month, as always, joins us in studio on what is now officially one of many Football Fridays to come between now and the end of the year. Dr. Perea, we know you love that. I have to ask you, and we'll get to a variety of subjects as we go along, and of course you're free to jump in along the phone lines at 303-228-1043, the Total Beverage text line at 29588. Our open there, which I would insist on every Football Friday be the standard open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. If it were up to me, of course, it is not. Thankful in many ways, I'm sure, in many cases out there listening, that that is the case. But in that open, there is the little soundbite, the great one from George Allen, the wonderful football coach, a fascinating case study. From the Los Angeles Rams and the Washington Redskins, most memorably. Also spent some time in the United States Football League as a head coach. Every time you lose, you die a little bit. Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State University of Colorado. You subscribe to the George Allen theory that every time you lose, now he's talking in a football context now, every time you lose, you die a little bit.
You do. Absolutely.
I love that.
Yeah.
So you believe in what he is saying.
Oh, absolutely. After a loss.
Might seem extreme to some.
Well, it might seem extreme, but when you go through all the preparation that we do in football, you know, you're Chris Dempsey, I listened to him coming on, and he was talking about the attention to detail that he saw out at Dove Valley.
As opposed to your standard NBA training camp, for example.
Right. And systemically, the NFL and football in general lends itself to a lot of detail. I mean, the preparation for game is just exceedingly obsessive.
And what even in the preseason.
Absolutely. And what most people, because what most people don't realize, it is the preseason, but you're already gearing for the Ravens. I'll guarantee you the coaching staff has already broke down tape of the Ravens and always in little ways is making preparation. So when George Allen says that you die a little bit, I completely relate to that. You know, I'm coaching my 10-year-old son. It's his first season in Little League football. And we had a scrimmage last night. And we did what we call inside hole, where just the inside six people are playing and you're working against run. And we played a higher one age group up, and they handed it to us. And I went home, and I was surprised how empty I felt. I thought, "Why, my goodness, this is Little League football." But whether it's the NFL, college, high school, or even Little League, evidently, it's that element of preparation. So much energy goes into it that when you get defeated, there a small part of you dies. I would say it's probably about a 12 to 24-hour process, and then you recover. Then you get your bearings back, and you're ready to go back at it.
And that was kind of, I think, what George Allen meant. George had a way of stating things in absolute ways and exaggerated ways, perhaps, at times. But I think that's what he was getting at.
Yeah.
And that's part of the Lombardi philosophy, too,
right.
where there's no such thing as second place. They're first or you're last, in effect. There's
right.
no such thing as second
yeah.
place.
See, my roots come from a coach named Bill Jacobs who – is from the Ohio Valley.
Yeah.
Back where Saban and Woody
right.
Hayes and all those guys are from.
Yeah.
And it's from the philosophy as, you know, you don't shoot for second place. You shoot for first place. And even if you win, you're still right back on the horse again preparing for that next game. There's no time for celebration. There's no time for patting yourself on the back. So when you do lose, Sandy, there is a psychological imbalance, okay, that you have to, you know, try to restore. And that 12 to 24 hours after a loss is very, very hollow for most players and coaches who care. And so when George Allen says a little bit of you dies, I can completely relate to that assertion.
Can losing be a good thing, a constructive thing? Do you learn anything from losing? There's probably a debate in the psychological field about all of that. Where do you come down on good coming out of losing?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to learn and grow. I think when you think about winning, okay, whether it's the high school, college, or professional level, whether we're talking about soccer, football, basketball, volleyball, you name it, when you win, generally the team spends a lot of time celebrating, you know, congratulating each other, coaches saying, hey, did a good job, we executed our plan. But when you lose, it forces a level of introspection, a level of self-analysis to say, okay, what could we have done better? And that really is a beautiful stage for analysis and critical thinking and going back and saying, okay, we had a game plan, we had a scheme, we had a preparation, what didn't go right? So it causes you to really introspect, Sandy, and look at what you're doing on a daily basis, because when you win, you tend to think, okay, let's just go get prepared for the next team, and you can start developing your scouting report and you go on from there. But when you lose, it causes some deep introspection, a deep analysis of what not only you could have done, but your team could have done as a group and as an organization to win that game.
We brought you on first back in the middle of January, just days following the playoff loss to Baltimore. So you've had 7 months basically to ruminate on this, and we've asked you a lot about it. It's probably the topic we've addressed most thoroughly with you in the ensuing months, and now here again today as you look back almost 7 months to the day, a little more than 7 months ago. Have the Broncos, from what you've been able to observe, learned the right lessons from January 12th's loss to the Ravens in the playoffs?
I think they have a unique opportunity to learn. Now, and what I mean by this, the stage is set. There's been a lot of distractions at Dove Valley in the offseason,
which we will get to shortly.
And that may be a blessing in disguise.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, because I think if you sit here and toil and waver over the loss to the Ravens and think about all the things that could have gone, you know, in a different direction, I think that could be a distraction and really suck the life out of a team. I think all the distractions at Dove Valley may have been a blessing in disguise, because it's taken some of the foci away from being able to say, okay, my gosh, okay, they're our first game, we're pointing towards them, we're thinking about getting revenge, those type of things. And now they've been forced, you know, out of their hand, but they've been forced to look at a lot of different elements in the front office, with player personnel,
yes,
with movement. So I think, honestly, I would look at it, and if I were the psychological leader in that organization, I would spin it in a positive way, in that it's distracted a lot of their players from really intensely focusing. Because let me tell you something. I played golf with a kid that got drafted in the fifth round by the Ravens, and he broke his ankle recently, so he's going to be on injury reserve. But the Ravens are talking about this game. The Ravens are intensely talking about this game because they know it's a trap game. They know it's a psychological trap game. And I'll tell you what, whether they'll admit to their media or not, the Broncos are clearly on the radar screen of the Ravens.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And we'll get into some conversation. Manning's leadership, I know that's a subject we've addressed with you. We were just talking about it with Chris Dempsey, and I thought he put it in an interesting way. The leadership oozes out of Manning, and the manifestation of that is players, even when they're not asked about Manning, particularly offensive players, inevitably make reference to him, bring him into the conversational exchange. Dr. Rick Barea, our guest, as we continue in studio throughout this next hour on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Dr. Rick Barea, our studio guest, in studio for the entire hour. Sandy Clef with you as Clef Talk continues on this Football Friday, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. 303-228-1043 on the phones, 29588 on the Total Beverage text line with Dr. Perea. We've spent a great deal of time over the last few months talking about the subject of leadership. We addressed it in the first hour as far as the Broncos are concerned. Chris Dempsey comparing the Bronco leadership quite favorably with that of the Nuggets at this point within the player ranks, and talking specifically about Manning. The leadership oozes out of Manning, Chris Dempsey told us in the first hour from the Denver Post. Does that mean something to you when he says something like that? Do you know exactly what he's talking about
when
it comes to Manning?
Yes. Peyton Manning is what we call a transformational leader. And what that is they affect cultures and climates by their deep thirst. And I mean psychological thirst. Their need and thirst to change and get better. You know, there's different types of leadership. Transactional leadership, for example, is somebody who kind of manages situations. And those type of leaders usually don't lead until there's something pathological that occurs. There's something wrong that occurs, and then they'll jump in and lead. It's kind of leadership when they have to. But transformational leaders, those people, the Nick Sabans of the world, the Peyton Mannings of the world, they look for opportunities to get better. You know, right after Alabama won the national championship, 2 days later, Nick Saban was on the phone looking for motivational speakers for the next spring. He knew that although they won a national championship, he needed to get better. There were gaps, okay? And Peyton Manning is one of those people. You'd look at it the way he prepares himself, both as an individual and as an athlete. There's no gap. He's just relentless in trying to get better. He doesn't look for opportunities to say, okay, well, let's just keep doing what we're doing. He wants to always look for methodologies and ways to improve himself, and that's what we call a transactional leader. So when the players talk about Peyton Manning, and they often refer to him as number 18, when they talk about him, they realize it's very evident in their face. There's a lot of evidence that he's a leader because he's a kind of transformational leader that transforms climates and cultures by modeling behavior that others seem to emulate.
That even defensive players can't stop talking about.
Yes, because when you line up against 18, he's going to present some problems for you. He's clearly understands matchups. I mean, the NFL is about creating mismatches, whether it's at the offensive line or receivers or whatever position it is. You're about creating mismatches. And he has that cognitive ability, that thinking ability to able to think on the run and look for mismatches and exploit mismatches. So on the defensive end, you're thinking to yourself, we're trying to minimize the mismatches while he's trying to exploit them. And he's a master at doing such.
And talk about leadership. Where does mental toughness come in terms of a psychological perspective? When you talk about leadership, and I think people understand, that's a big part of the way people think about the game and how they relate to leaders and how leaders relate to them. But the mental toughness aspect, whether you're talking individually or collectively, how does that come forth? How do we know whether a team has it or doesn't have it?
That's a great question. It is related to leadership. Mental toughness is kind of the layperson's way of describing a self-belief system, self-efficacy, and also attentional focus. I'll break them down like this. Number one, self-efficacy. We've talked about it before on this show, but self-efficacy is a psychological word for confidence. And that means that you have built up a belief system. And in other words, when you come up against adversity, how do you overcome that? Do you have a methodology? Do you talk yourself using positive self-talk? How do you, really orchestrate your behavior to get through that? And that's called self-efficacy. And unfortunately, many teams don't test for this. You look back at the Jamarcus Russell situation, and Jamarcus Russell physiologically tested off the books.
I mean, off the charts.
The kid was just, he was unbelievable. I mean, he could throw the long ball. He could throw the short ball, had great size. But what we didn't have evidence of is that adversity that he had had to overcome, whether it was at the high school level, he was very successful. At the college level, he was very successful. So when he came up against adversity in the NFL, which he did, which you're going to as a quarterback, you're going to have to go through passing progressions and have to analyze those. He was not able to do that. The Raiders did not have a record of that because he didn't have a sense of self-efficacy. The second phase of that is being able to filter out irrelevant cues and focus on relevant cues. And what that systematically means, Sandy, is that you take, let's use an outside linebacker, for example, okay? What we call a Sarah or a Sam linebacker, strong side linebacker. When they line up, they have certain keys they have to read, okay? If they're lined up over the tight end, that tight end blocks down. His cue is that head. When that head goes down, he steps with his right hand, keeping his hips and shoulders square to the line of scrimmage, and he's got his gap responsibility. That's all he's thinking about. Irrelevant cues is the ball. People think linebackers should follow the ball. No, they read their keys, they step with their key, they fulfill their gap responsibility, and the ball will come to them. That's focusing on relevant cues versus filtering out the irrelevant cues. And the great players like the Michael Jordans, the John Elways, the Peyton Mannings of the world are able to minimize the relevant cues to one or two a play and filter out the 10 to 12 that a lot of other players plug into.
It's interesting. You used, and we'll break here and give you a chance to consider this and respond when we come back. You used Tiger Woods as an example of someone with ability to filter out those irrelevant cues that you're talking about. And it is amazing, except these days when he gets to a major. What happens to someone, I think, who does fit your description here for most of the year outside of the four weekends, it seems now, in which the majors take place? Why does some of that mental toughness that is so much in evidence whenever he plays outside of major tournament competition, why does that go away during the majors? And we'll talk about that, get back into some football discussion. And the point Dr. Perea made most compellingly in the first segment today, could these off-field distractions considered harmful by most of us, yours truly included? Dr. Perea said it could be a hidden benefit, even a blessing in disguise, as far as the Broncos are concerned. This is your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe. Can't you see that I am not afraid? What was that promise that you made?
Why it is 10:31 on a Football Friday. Sandy Clef with you on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. You're home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest, making his monthly appearance. We'll increase the frequency of Dr. Perea's appearances once the football season starts for real, with a regular season on Thursday night, September 5th, with the Baltimore Ravens. And I want to get to the Tiger Woods question, because as you explain the ingredients of mental toughness, you have identified Tiger Woods as one who exemplifies that kind of mental toughness, except it seems these days on the weekends of majors. What happens to Tiger during the majors?
Yeah.
That seems so different from the guy who is so obviously otherwise the best player in the world again.
Yeah. Well, first let me frame what he does in terms of his, you know, relevant cues versus irrelevant cues. A lot of people, you know, would say that Tiger Woods is distant on the golf course. He doesn't walk by and, you know, give people five.
Never interacts with the fans.
Right. But what people should understand is this man is supremely focused. And when he steps on the golf course, he has one or two attentional cues that he plays to on every shot. And before he hits a shot, he's cognitively focused on each shot. So I would credit him. I mean, if you look at his record, I mean, I think he's up to 80 tour wins. And although he's kind of stuck on 14 majors, we can clearly say that he has an advantage in terms of attentional focus. Now, why would he maybe be operating from a deficit base when it comes to majors? Because he's probably cognitively framing it in a different way. You know, I'm sure whoever's working with him from a mental enhancement perspective has pointed this out, where I at least hope they have. But he is cognitively reframing it in a different way than he is other tournaments. I think one of the statistics he knows he has to reach if he's going to be considered the greatest of all time is to break Jack's 18-major win record.
And he talked about and clearly focused on earlier in his career. But now you hear him before the PGA recently saying things like, well, I've got five wins on the regular tour this year. I've had a great year, whether I win a major or not. That seems a very different sentiment from the one he used to express when it was all around the majors. Every season was built around the majors and succeeding in the majors. Everything else was window dressing. Now he's saying, with or without a major title this year, I had a great year.
Yeah, but you know, Sandy, we have to be very careful as psychological practitioners and scholars to understand what comes out of people's mouth we can't always believe. I think he's just really kind of trying to detract people by saying that. I think in his heart of hearts, five wins is good for him, but it's not what he wants. He wants majors. And whether he admits that or not, that's what he's thinking.
Of course.
You know, there's a term in psychology called cognitive dissonance. And what that means is there's a cognitive imbalance, if you will, in our mind. And right now he's experiencing that with the majors. And so what's happening is when he goes into a major, he's got this imbalance in the way he's framing it. And so what he's going to have to do is really work in the offseason with his mental enhancement coach in terms of framing majors as regular tournaments and filtering out all the irrelevant cues. One of the problems is when you go to a major, there's so much pageantry. There's so much surrounding the golf tournament that's above and beyond a typical tour event. And he's got to filter all those things out to be able to focus on the relevant cues, which is his golf swing, his routine, and his technique.
All right, from the Total Beverage text line at 29588, back to the Broncos, and I guess the Broncos and Ravens specifically, from the 720. Could you ask Dr. Perea about the fans here in Denver? If we're watching the Ravens lose 7 or even 8 of their starters from last year, and the Broncos essentially have the same team, why is there such fear of this game in the minds of the fans if the Broncos are supposedly the odds-on favorite to win the Super Bowl this year, 5-1 according to certain Las Vegas odds makers, as opposed to 30-1? Why is there such fear, insecurity in the psychology of the fan base regarding this game? The Broncos are at least as good, maybe better. The Ravens have lost 7 or 8 starters from their Super Bowl championship team. Is the paranoia or fear, paranoia is probably too strong, justify? Where does it come from?
Yeah, well,
explain that.
What the texter just analyzed was personnel. That's one piece, Andy. Personnel is one piece of the equation in the game. You know, it doesn't, you know, whether the Ravens lost 7, and by the way, I'll mention the Broncos defense is going to have at least 5 different pieces this year, maybe as much as 7. So when we talk about.
So you don't necessarily buy his premise
no.
that the Ravens have been radically changed over and the
right.
Broncos are essentially have stayed static.
Right. But let's assume, for the sake of this argument, let's assume that he's on target with that. You still have team cohesion. You still have the ability to play with each other. You know, one of those things we talk about in sports psychology is team cohesion. And how is that fostered? Because personnel is one element. And if it was as easy as just getting the best personnel out there in the world, the Yankees would have won multitude of titles.
Rather than just one since 2000.
Right. So it's more than just personnel. It's team cohesion. It's that ability to play with each other, that ability to play for each other, and reach a higher level of motivation and performance. So I would say that if someone is really concerned about the Ravens game, they should be, because there's more to it than just personnel deployment. There's scheme. There's cohesion. There's all these different factors and variables that make up the whole pie that go into winning football games.
And it is interesting that the Ravens not only signed Dumervilleaux, but this past week bring in Stokely and Dallas Clark, who's, of course, very familiar to Peyton Manning. But the Stokely signing and again, to analyze that, is it a sign of desperation on the part of the Ravens in the absence of Bolden and Pitta, the tight end, getting hurt? Or is it a very savvy combination of moves to bring in those two guys?
I think that the personnel department for the Ravens, including Harbaugh, because he has to sign off on this,
sure.
by the way, is doing a very astute psychological
no.
dance. Okay? Because, I mean, Stokely, let's be honest. I mean, is Stokely going to be a difference maker? Maybe, maybe not. But at least it's an acquisition that gets people thinking. Because, I mean, there's some trade-offs going on here, okay? I mean, the Dumervilleaux piece, Stokely, and all the elements that really go back to the last playoff game, I honestly think Harbaugh is playing a psychological dance. I mean, he with personnel. And anything you can do to get an advantage in this league is important. So I give one check on his belt to Harbaugh for really kind of throwing something in the mix that could, you know, just add to fuel to the fire for this
matchup. And
back
to your point about how you've heard that the Ravens are thinking and talking about this game maybe as much as the Broncos are.
Yeah. Well, they're very well prepared psychologically and mentally that this could be a trap game, that this could be a game that, you know, the Broncos are going to come in with revenge on their mind, and the Ravens have been very well prepared to get, you know, prepare for this game that they're not the ones that are just taking it for granted. So I think that it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I'll make the prediction right now. Whichever team turns the ball over less, I think, you know, has a 94% chance to win. So that's a big factor. But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because I can tell you this. The Ravens have marked this game in red on their calendar as well.
All right, Tavon Miller, you see a potential silver lining in all that's going on around Von Miller at this point? Explain.
Well, I think there's a potential silver lining in the sense that, you know, when you suffer a defeat like the Broncos did to the Ravens last January, that can be emotionally and psychologically deflating. Some of these things that have happened off the field are really, you know, challenging the Broncos on a lot of levels, but at the same time, it's enough of a distraction so they're not so focused, the players are so focused on that specific loss. I think it's a chance for Von Miller to look inside, to really kind of introspect and get his, you know, work stuff in order, his life in order, and also the Broncos to be very honest about where Von Miller is and his development. I think the Broncos need to really do what they have to do to protect their investment. They have a multi-million dollar investment in this player, and they've got to do everything they can to really help him reach his potential. So I would go back and say that all the things that have happened off the field really are a distraction, but maybe a distraction from the on-the-field things, enough so that they can just get to work and focus on football.
There's the aspect of the potential suspension that would tangibly affect the Broncos if it's four games, three games, two games, or even one, since the one would be Baltimore, and that would be the first one. The attitude out at Dove Valley regarding Miller now seems to be one not necessarily of great concern, but being puzzled as to how disorganized he seems to be away from Dove Valley, away from the complex, away from the structure that football provides. Would that be disturbing to you as an outsider, but a professionally experienced outsider looking at this, that he seems so disorganized, even inept in some of his off-field dealings?
Well, in defense of Vaughn, okay, I would say that there's a lot of NFL players that are guilty of some of the things that he's done. For all intents and purposes, it happens to illuminate with him right now. And, you know, it's just kind of the snowball is getting bigger and bigger. But, you know, there's a lot of players that are in his shoes. I mean, I'm going to be quite honest. I deal with a lot of players, and there's a lot of players that really have personal assistants that take care of a lot of their stuff. And it teaches them not to really be responsible with their own, you know, their obligations on a daily basis. So I think that he is a player that will respond, and I think he has matured through a lot of this. But I also think the Broncos need to look at, again, how they assess players coming out of college. Because if we're going to be really honest here, they knew a lot of this about him. And
that was the only question about Miller coming out.
Yeah.
Centering on issues of maturity.
Right. And, you know, we can go back to A&M, and there's documentation of what he went through there. So they knew a lot of this was going on. They had hoped that, you know, through the symposiums and through the mandated things that the NFL puts the rookies through now, that that's enough education to help some of these players realize where they need to be. But in someone like Vaughn's case, there's obviously, you know, some other symptoms that we're seeing, and they really need to take responsibility to really protect their investment. And I think Vaughn has learned a lot during this, and I think he'll respond. But going back to this four-game suspension, if he misses those four games, I often tell people this. There's so much repetition it goes to the effectiveness of a linebacker in terms of their gap responsibilities and movement and fluidity and trying to get to the ball. It's really not 4 weeks. It's essentially 6 weeks, because it's going to take him 2 weeks to get back into practice and really kind of get that those repetitions. You know, we call them SATs, their stance, alignment, and technique, to where he needs to be the effective player he's been the last 2 years.
That's interesting. So we talk more about the effect on the team. You would say we should be talking more about the effect of a potential suspension on Von Miller.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
The team will adjust. It might be harder for Miller to recover from the lost time.
Absolutely. I think as an individual, your stance, alignment, technique, that's something you got to rep. And he can't go to Dove Valley and rep that.
Yeah.
You know, he can do it on his own with his own individual trainers, but it's not the live bullets that you're going to see once a week in practice.
Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest, always fascinating, and we'll continue and we'll delve in, speaking of psychological challenges, the Colorado Rockies. For the first time in 7 months, we have given Dr. Perea an assignment that even he may not be equipped to take on. We'll see, though. We'll challenge him momentarily on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Dr. Rick Perea, our studio guest, Sandy Clef with you on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Total Beverage text line at 295-88, 303-228-1043 on the phones. We were touching earlier on the subject of how consistent winning comes about. What does that come out of? Programs, you mention Saban all the time, you know him well, that they produce consistent winning. A lot of championships, a lot of greatness in what they've built at Alabama, certainly, but consistent winning. And I thought it was fascinating in Sports Illustrated's College Football Preview Edition this week. Q&A with Saban. The question, when you're on vacation, do you turn off your phone? Saban's answer, not much. Maybe 90% of the day I can do what I want to do, but I'm going to do what I have to do, that 10%, to keep things going in the right direction. And I thought with that short question and almost as concise a response, captured Nick Saban. And you know him a lot better than I do. What's your reaction to that? That explains to me why he's so good, even brilliant at what he does.
Yeah, well, that ratio, that 90-10 ratio, I would even venture to say it's more 50-50. He was being generous there. He does what he needs to do to win championships. And one of the things that goes into that is consistency on staff. You know, you brought up about how, you know, there's a lot of change going on in the world of sport. His staff is so consistent. You know, Joe Panunzio, who's their assistant athletic director, and him and I are former college teammates, but he talks to me about how consistent they are with their staff, and he does so much he can to keep those guys. You know, McElwain left as his offensive coordinator here now at CSU.
Yes.
But he really tries to keep his position coaches and his coordinators rewarded and really feeling good about their job because he knows how important that is. So I think that a transformational leader like a Saban is somebody that looks ahead and says, okay, what do I got to do to keep consistency, not only in the staff, but in players as well. You look at how he disciplined. He had a few freshmen that came in last year and were involved with stealing some laptops, and he acted within hours. They were gone. There was none of this suspension piece. They were gone. There was a clear message sent that that will not be tolerated in our organization. He's that kind of a systematic transformational leader that really sends a message to everybody. And the key element of that, Sandy, is consistency in staff and also personnel.
On to the Colorado Rockies, who to some represent the antithesis of all of that. Certainly when it comes to consistent winning, they have not been able to achieve that. And you talk about their climate, their culture, and the need for change there. But it has to be the right change. It has to be the smart change. Give me your general sense of the Rockies, who continue this year seemingly to be going nowhere in a hurry.
Yeah. Well, first of all, my first question for the Rockies is there genuine need or thirst to win? Because if there is to win, there's not the right leadership in place. I can tell you that. I mean, it's just obvious. The climate and culture is set by the people at the top of your organization. And, you know, Dan O'Dowd is an interesting subject to me. I used to see him on a regular basis at Cherry Creek High School. I'd run into him here and there.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one of the things in psychology that we look at is nonverbal communication. And that basically are people's facial expressions, their gestures, how they walk, how they move. Now, we're not, you know, witch doctors. We can't read people's mind. But there are definite signs you can look at people and get a clear indication of how they feel about themselves, their self-concept, if you will. And Dan O'Dowd has always struck me as a reticent communicator. As a reticent behavior. I mean, he's distant. He's not.
Yeah, there's a loner aspect.
Yes.
A bit isolated. And, you know, some of us of a certain personality type can even relate to that in terms of our own experience and our own temperament.
Right, but when you are setting the climate and culture of a competitive baseball team in that climate, you have to have somebody who is vibrant, who is really engaging, who engages the manager, who engages the players, and really sets an overall tone for that organization. You know, in organizational psychology, the most important person of that organization is the CEO, because they set the climate and culture. And they distribute that and deploy that throughout their upper management and middle management. And Dan O'Dowd, for me, if the Rockies are serious about winning, he's the one piece that they haven't replaced in a long time that I think needs to be changed.
But they've clearly changed his role, at least in a public sense. He's been essentially removed from public view. Whether his actual role has changed, we know his title hasn't, but his actual role within the organization, that we don't know. But we do know, because if there is an expression to be made about the team in general, it's Bill Guyvette who is making the statement, it's not Dan O'Dowd anymore.
Well,
is that just surface stuff to you? Does O'Dowd still, as you seem to be suggesting, set the cultural tone for the organization?
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as he's a part of it.
As long as he's a part of it, he is going to have a dramatic influence. You know, Guyvette, too. I mean, I saw him in a few interviews as well.
Sure.
You know, he's a little short, a little tart with his answers as well, too. And I think those of us that study organizations,
yeah.
I mean, we research this, Sandy, and I think it's so important that people understand this. We've got to have engaging, passionate people who really want to really distribute a leadership, you know, acumen that really will motivate people. I mean, it's unmistakable. When you're around a passionate person, a passionate leader, they really just evoke all that elements of human behavior from everyone around them. And when
you don't see that anywhere on any level with the Rockies, do you?
No,
in the
nowhere.
Playing ranks, you really don't see it.
Nowhere.
In the managing ranks, you really don't see it. Certainly in the front office, ownership, you don't see on no level within the organization do you see that kind of expression.
And I'll contrast it with the Broncos. You know, Pat Bowlen's not the most expressive person, but I'll goddamn guarantee that guy wants to win. John Elway he is as competitive as they come, and he wears it on his sleeves at times, too. But in the Rockies organization, there's really not a Pied Piper kind of guy that's going to get anybody rallied. And people say, well, that's not their job in the front office. But they set the climate and the culture that trickles down on a daily basis of expectations. And in psychology, there's a clear theory of expectancy theory that you will achieve what you're expected to. And I'll guarantee you that if somebody came in that like a Nick Saban or somebody with that kind of just thirsty psychological need to succeed, he'd turn it around. He doesn't even have to know baseball. He could get in that culture. Interestingly enough, we've studied leadership enough to know, Sandy, if you're the great leader at IBM, we could plug you into the Broncos, and you may not know X's and O's, but you can change the overall climate and culture of that organization. The same thing. It doesn't even have to be a baseball person, and that's what we're discovering in higher education. The presidents of higher education institutions all used to be academics.
Right.
Now, who are they? They're business leaders. They're organizational leaders, because we've discovered that we need to have that kind of acumen to lead our organizations into the future. And the same thing I think what's going to happen in the next 20 to 30 years, you're going to see, is that athletic teams would do very well to plug and really pluck out some of the talent in the organizational and business culture.
One quick question, and it probably would take the better part of an hour to answer properly, but on the Total Beverage text line at 29588, on the 720, Dr. Perea, why are so many gifted people great at that singular focus, but disasters in other aspects of life?
Getting back to the Vaughn Miller subject. Well, because, I mean, the truth of the matter is they're not disastrous at those other areas. It appears to be.
Yeah.
We're all born with competencies and acumen, and we develop those on a lot of different levels. But Vaughn Miller really could be a very organized person. He hasn't been required to be that way. So I would say this. It's like teaching a child in school. You know, we sometimes label kids as smart and some of those not as smart.
But we all know people mature at different rates, and at different times.
Yes. And I would say for him, he needs to develop certain skill sets. And it's not whether he's bright or he's not bright. He just needs to develop skill sets. And I put that back on the Broncos again. What's the responsibility of the Broncos? Because this is your employee. And again, it's one of your star employees. And how are you going to cultivate them? How are you going to develop them and protect that investment, not only from a financial perspective for your overall organization, but from a personnel perspective? You need Vaughn with a clear mind, with clear set physiologically to be able to perform on the field. And you have to do whatever you have to do as a leader in that organization to ensure that he has all he needs so he can do that. So I would tell the texter.
You're talking about more upper management responsibility,
yes,
as opposed to the head coach or any member of the coaching staff.
Or organizational coaches. You know, in the business world, IBM probably has 50 organizational coaches in any one region that comes in and coaches CEOs and CFOs how to reach people. The NFL, all professional sports need to learn from that.
Well, in a profound way, I know you reach our audience every month when we have you on. We'll do this a little more often now that we know you're fired up about the start of the football season, particularly here in Denver with the Broncos, and we look forward to the rest of the year and the ensuing months and more of a chance to visit with you.
Thank you for having me, Sandy. Always great to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest, an hour ahead on a Football Friday. Your home for the best live and local coverage, the Broncos and the NFL, is Denver's Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.